One. Cool. Boom. We're live, to quote Joe Rogan. Hey, Jasmine.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good.
Awesome. Okay, cool. So you just wrote an article on the gender gap in agriculture. Do you want to like tell us how you got started on that article?
Yeah, for sure. So I guess like pretty much my degree is econ, and I'm also really interested in women's issues. So I kind of wanted to see how we could tie those two things together. And I think it's always interesting to look at how different gender gaps persist. And one that I hadn't really seen a lot about, but one of my profs was actually pretty heavily researching, was this idea of a gender gap in the productivity of agriculture. So pretty much just saying that in general, it's consistently found that women are less productive in agriculture than men. And it's kind of obvious that it's not, due to any sort of work ethic issues, that there must be something bigger there. So I think that that was kind of why I wanted to look into this to see like why this was. And yeah, I mean, food production is a huge, I mean, it's the whole shtick of our like livelihood. So I think it's cool to look into that. But yeah.
Yeah, that's really like most of the economies still on Earth are still based on this agricultural surplus and like agricultural farming and stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, so what did you find really?
Yeah. So I think essentially I just found that it's pretty well ingrained that women just have less empowerment when it comes to being able to invest in good capital, invest in good labor, invest in good inputs, essentially, which kind of just results in them having a lower output, a less good product, kind of less fruitful use of the land. And so that also results in them having less output, which means that they have less input because they make less money, they make less, just output in general, that they just don't have the means to put money back into their production. So essentially they're just behind when it comes to their production and their production capabilities. So it's kind of interesting because women are actually the dominant workers in a lot of farming industries. So it's kind of interesting why we're not addressing these barriers that they have to be able to be empowered to own their own land and stuff like that. Stuff that would make them a lot more efficient, but there's just all these cultural barriers in the way, also like educational barriers in the way that kind of stop them from being able to be productive when making, agricultural decisions and agricultural production.
Okay, so what do you mean by they're the most prominent agricultural workers, or they're the most prominent agricultural landowners? Because I do know there is a bit of a difference there.
Yeah, for sure. So they're definitely not the most prominent landowners, for sure. They're the most prominent workers. So if you kind of look at where your produce comes from, specifically from, South America and West Africa, you're kind of looking at this interesting kind of dynamic between very, very few landowners that each, employ thousands of workers, most of whom are female, whereas most of the landowners are male. So it's kind of this idea of collecting surplus from all of these women, collecting all of their hard efforts, and keeping it for themselves, rather than kind of empowering these women to own their own land and be able to understand better agricultural practices so that they don't have to use this intensive types of farming that not only erode the land, but also just yield lower outputs, which then yields lower inputs and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
So what kind of advancements could be made based on what you read for your article?
I think one of the biggest ones is just like empowering women to own their own land. I think I just keep harping on that, but it's
Yeah.
true. Just being able to be autonomous in like all different types of markets. So whether that's a capital market, the land market, the labor market, it's actually really interesting, but women in a lot of countries cannot hire their own labor. It seems really messed up, but it's just true, especially when it comes to physical labor. There are a lot of barriers that kind of make it really difficult for women to have men work for them in kind of like a physical labor capacity, and even other women for that matter. But yeah, I think definitely being able to actually independently, without having a man sign off on it, all that kind of stuff, independently buy and purchase and invest in their own products. The other thing I think is just education on, generally in a lot of societies, this is a huge generalization, but women aren't as educated on the means of production. So I think even just to know how to tend to the land, it's in a lot of communities, it's passed down from father to father and not necessarily to the women. So I think just kind of understanding like basic agriculture, as well as basic accounting, basic understanding of like this many seeds for this much output, all that kind of stuff. And the final is just like encouraging collectives where women can kind of share with each other, share with other men, share with, I don't know, the community, different ways to tend to the land and different ways to produce enough agriculture.
Now, when we talk about barriers to women owning property, is that, what kind of barriers are these? Are these like cultural or?
Like yeah, so that's kind of an interesting question, because right off the bat, I just assumed they were cultural. I just assumed that it just wasn't the custom for women to, you know, go out and buy a plot of land and live there alone. But, and of course those do exist, and those are kind of the main barriers, but in a lot of countries there's legal barriers. In a lot of more conservative countries, there is kind of, you either have to give up certain rights as a woman to be able to own land, or you have to have a male relative or someone sign off on it. I think the other kind of piece of this puzzle that's missing and pretty important is this idea of interacting with other landowners, interacting with other business people. I think that's kind of a component of the cultural barrier that comes in, that even if, you know, it's legal, you have a supportive community, you're financially empowered, and you invest in a plot of land, the people that you're dealing with might not necessarily treat you. You know, it's like the typical kind of, they take advantage of you, they know things you don't know. It's just, it's, I think it's difficult that even once you get there, you don't have a lot of options in terms of autonomously being able to control your own land. I feel like it's definitely a bit of a game. So yeah, a lot of barriers that aren't just necessarily directly legal or cultural.
What do you think about legal literacy training and education?
I think that's huge. I think legal literacy, financial literacy, those are both huge components to this whole issue. I think the biggest thing is just understanding your rights, because in a lot of, you know, circumstances, although there are legal barriers, that's generally not the case in like the vast majority of countries. So just understanding your rights and understanding that you do deserve the place that you're in, and you're allowed to, you know, go ahead and invest in these different things. So yeah, I think it's super important.
So did you come across a term? I just did readings on this before we started, from the International Food Policy Research Institute. Mm-hmm. So did you come across a term of extension? I don't know if it's extension policy, but extension practices. And what are your thoughts on those practices that would improve, that could have the potential to improve women's empowerment now in agriculture?
I'm not really sure this, I don't know if you don't mind like explaining it a little bit, and I can let you know what I think.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So the definition of extension practices that I came across was how to extend basically farm education, better technologies, better seeds, and the methods of that extension. So I read an article about extension in Ethiopia, gender differences and access to extension services and agricultural productivity by Bergasa, Berhane, Tedesi, and Seum Hefesi. And essentially the extension practices revolve around how best to extend these new tools through either government agencies in Ethiopia. It's this thing called the DA, or I believe DA, or through non-governmental structural. So radio, television, I guess NGOs would be a part of that, and community too, like farming community. So from my reading of it, there was a gendered component to a lot of these extension practices. So I just wanted to know, what are your thoughts for extension practices and implementing them?
I think that's kind of interesting. I think, like, based on my understanding, it just all comes down to, like, kind of getting rid of this. I feel like this is such a basic answer. It's just kind of the answer to everything, but just getting rid of barriers to education for women in general, and just kind of, you know, women's equality, feminism, whatever it might be. But at the end of the day, I think understanding the skills that will empower the community to be better, and then trying to, as a government, as a community resource, an NGO, whatever it might be, trying to make everyone better off will make everyone better off, if that makes sense. I think that it's the idea behind it, and the idea behind trying to make sure that everyone's got the tools at their disposal isn't just to, you know, make those individual women better off, which that alone should be a good enough incentive, but, you know, sometimes it's just not. But it should be this idea that, and I kind of refer to this at the end of my article, that if those women are better off, the agricultural productivity is going to be better, GDP will be higher, poverty will be lower, and that just kind of makes it a better place for everyone. So I just think, like, these are worthwhile endeavors, and I think the most worthwhile endeavor is just first and foremost focusing on creating equality. That sounds like a very sad and conclusive way to answer that, but I guess it's true.
Yeah, it essentially, that's what the authors of the paper did write in regards to just increasing the way that these methods, well, first they examined data sets about how women responded to each, like, to the various extension practices. And then they looked at the comparison to, like, men, and which ones are more effective in each community. And what they found was that the government officials, like DA, like anything concrete government, like advice, was going to be more beneficial to women, and women and men would listen to it more than necessarily like communal practices and radio and stuff. One of the problems of that was how to get, and I looked at this in another paper too, for Mozambique. I'll just pull it up here. It's just a strategy support program kind of thing. And essentially what they argue is that understanding this dissemination of, like, sustainable land management techniques, you have to take into account, like, there's a gendered aspect to extension practices. So women have been found to be more responsive to women offering these techniques than to men, because there's that component of, that component of understanding where each other kind of comes from and those experiences of each other. So I guess, like, a broader question for you is, do you know of any methods to properly implement or to better implement women into government? Like, because I know your article was about sub-Saharan Africa. So Did you come across any methods to better implement women into those systems?
I think actually this kind of goes along the lines of exactly what you were saying, but just building off the idea that the messenger is really important. The message is pretty consistent throughout the different organizations, but when it comes to something like, you know, having news disseminated on the radio or through word of mouth or on television, it directly feeds into the distortions of the culture in that community. Whereas when you have something that is maybe the law, just like, I know that the laws, you know, social encouragement or, you know, encouragement through TV and people coming to the community and stuff like that, saying girls need to go to school, that's, you know, one thing, and that gives room for people to give their interpretation and argue. But for it to be a federal law that girls have to go to school and there will be a fine if girls don't go to school from the federal government, that is a whole nother kind of ball game in terms of what people receive as sort of the status quo. So I think, yeah, based off of my kind of very preliminary opinion, I think enforcing, I guess just enforcement in general is kind of the key to these things. I think introducing these ideas is great, but there is this kind of level of things are the way they are and things work, quote unquote, the way they are. And in order for progress to happen and in order for just change in general to happen and for women to be seen as worthy of the same level of education, the same level of empowerment as men, it needs to become part of like the law of the land, so to speak. Yeah, I think that's kind of the way to go. I think the way to go is to like, yeah, just decree it that that's how it's supposed to be, rather than let people kind of sit on it and let it be distorted by cultural norms, I guess.
And that's always tricky, because I was just about to ask you, how do these implementations become better off in regards to cultural norms? Like, how do these implementations actually get implemented in areas where the cultural norms are so different, and how we have to take that into account if we want to talk about this like field and stuff? And just in regards to like the education thing, did you read the article Promising Approaches to Address the Needs of Poor Female Farmers, Resources, Constraints, and Interventions by Isambing? Yeah, you read that one? There was that interesting approach where they talked about how certain countries have been implementing credit extension programs, I believe, and essentially promising mothers credit and money to send their girls to send their kids to school. And yeah, I believe it happened in Mexico. There was like a good like 11%, 12% increase of girls going to school. So those, this paper is pretty good for, I guess, listeners. If anyone wants to check out some strategies, because it's pretty in-depth and it goes over a lot of scholarly like research and stuff. But so there was one thing in the article that you talked about in your paper that I was going to ask you about, but I can't remember it. It was a term. Give me a second here.
There's a good chance I don't know it, but we can see.
Oh, it was a. Oh man. Okay, I think I wrote it somewhere. It was a. Geez, I don't even know. I can't even remember anymore. It was like a term that we were going to talk about, and then. That's okay. I'll find it. So I guess my next question is, what did you learn from your case study of what's something specific you learned from sub-Saharan Africa that's specific to like that region about gender inequalities?
I guess like it is kind of nebulous to like layer convictions on statistics that are, you know, definitely like accurate, but may not show the whole picture. But I do think what I was most shocked by for sure is the amount that you invest into women's agriculture and their agricultural productivity, how much that increases overall GDP for countries that agriculture is a huge part of their GDP, is kind of shocking, to be honest, because I think that literally just gives the best incentive to invest in these programs and to invest in closing this gap. I think another huge thing is just how much of the world's food is grown by women. I think that's surprising. Although this is a case study just kind of around sub-Saharan Africa, the implications of it are pretty big. And it's hard to, you know, write something and think about like, how do I get people to care? Because that's kind of depressing sometimes. But this story kind of wrote itself in the sense of like, everybody's got a stake in it. And I think that's pretty cool. I also just think it's not talked about very much. I think when we talk about technology and when you talk about like science and tech and productivity, it's all turned into like cryptocurrency. And, you know, how can we live on Mars when we destroy this planet and, you know, stuff like that. But I think this is so worth talking about. This is cool. And this kind of takes together environmentalism, feminism, just how do we stay here longer? How do we make this a better life? Like, yeah, it's got cool stuff in it.
It's an interesting kind of intersection between how to properly implement like technology, policy, feminist ideals into some of these regions for sure. Mm-hmm. And yeah, a lot of people do only talk about, like, I find that people talk about a lot about the negative side of climate change, the negative technological side of climate change the most when we're talking about technology and how mm-hmm. bad innovation can be. So it was refreshing, I guess, doing research for this and learning a bit more about how technology does benefit remote areas that
are
lacking. So to bridge this into like common, like into this like contemporary discussion, what do you have any connections to, like, do you have any insight to like what's going on in like India in regards to female agriculture?
That's a really good question. I feel like I'm definitely not educated enough on that to speak to it, but I think that having a basic knowledge in this was like a phenomenal jumping point to be able to better understand the complexities of like all the stuff that's going down in India. And like, I think this can even be, yes, this is definitely a feminist issue, but I think this can be pushed so further than a feminist issue to generally just being like, you know, separated into a class issue as well, separated into an issue of people who give so much to society but don't really get much in return. Also just the idea of just reaping surplus. I think that's such an integral idea to everything that's happening. But yeah, I think generally having a better background on this and maybe just in primary school, learning where our food comes from and learning how our food is made can help kind of empower people to be able to stand up to what's happening in India and support people going through hard times there.
Yeah, I definitely agree that educating the like in school about where primary or sorry, educating in school about where the global food supply comes from, because we're so globalized now and mm-hmm. Canada doesn't really grow as much food as we used to.
Yeah.
I think for sure that educating children on where these structural inequalities lie with our agriculture is super important to understanding the world a lot better. And yeah, it adds whole new dimensions to what's happening in like India, for example. And it's pretty interesting. And I found what I wanted to ask you about. So I wanted to ask you about perception bias, because you wrote about it in your article. And if you could explain that, that'd be great. Yeah.
So essentially, okay, this is kind of a topic that I struggled with a little bit, because obviously I, you know, have whatever biases I have, and I think I speak with them and I have them very entrenched in me. But I think it's also interesting to, okay, on one hand, I feel like I have a lot of feelings about this. Generally, perception bias is just this bias that you have based on what stereotypes you think certain people have. I think it's very, very common when it comes to quote unquote rural communities and understanding. Let's say this is a good example. I think when you're talking about a rural community's economy and you reference something like a barter economy, I think that's not necessarily as pertinent. That's not necessarily true. It might be true, but it's it's not necessarily, you know, what's happening there. And I think that people definitely just carry these kind of biases around. And I think when it comes to an issue like this, you have these perception biases coming from literally all angles. You have it about how educated women are, how liberated and autonomous women are, how understanding men are, how life is. Do people spend 14 hours a day at work? Do people spend 8 hours a day at work? What does that look like? I think it's hard to understand these things, but in order to actually like combat this bias and to understand what's actually happening, I think it's kind of half the battle. I think when you look at certain statistics and see that actually this community has like 70% of women or women and girls are educated up to grade 12. And, you know, that seems like a shock to you. That's probably your perception bias at work. And, you know, in that case, it would be ridiculous to try and, you know, implement a policy that sends more girls to school. I think it'd be better to look at a policy that changed their curriculum or, you know, change cultural norms and something like that. So, yeah, I think it's an interesting concept to understand, because I think when you're writing, a lot of the time, your perception bias can come through as fact in your head. You can just say, well, that's just a fact. But at the same time, it's so deeply ingrained, you should kind of just start off as if you know nothing and work from there, I guess.
Yeah, like in the, so how does perception bias, it's very like psychological then, mm-hmm. and it's, how does it relate to our perception of female agriculture workers?
I think in a huge way, it relates to this idea that, I think on two hands. One hand, you can look at the idea that you wouldn't assume that women are really in the agricultural sector because physical labor, et cetera. On the other hand, you could assume that women in rural communities, all they do is tend to the land, and all they do is, you know, they're the homemaker, they work in agriculture. But I think where it really clouds the judgment of this idea is this, like this perception that there would be no difference between a man or a woman working physical labor in agricultural setting. And that's just not true. That's obviously, that's the whole point of the article, but yeah, it's just been documented not to be true. So I think it's kind of interesting that you have all these perceptions about where your food comes from, who participates in agriculture, et cetera, but you don't really stop to think, yes, it's a brutal and difficult job, but are there ways to make it better? Yes. Without completely eviscerating it? Yes. And I think that's important to consider.
There's definitely a lot of layered complexities with just mm-hmm. how to properly better implement that. But yeah, I didn't really know the full definition of perception bias. So thanks for dropping that on us.
But I hope it helped.
It really did. Okay. So I think we're at time. It's been a good 30 minutes. So I just want to thank you for coming on, Jasmine. It was great having you. And
yeah,
you really shed a lot of light onto this topic. And
yeah, it was definitely thanks for having me.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for coming on. So yeah, I think we'll just cut it here. I usually do the outro by myself and do it at the end. Wow. I don't know. All right.